John Baker. So a helicopter is being sent to that location. Pick it up from there.
Yes. And by that time, I, you know, had gravitated down to job control and then across the tarmac to the base ops where these helicopters were dispatched from. And I could see our wing commander in his staff car with his little general sign on the side of it, and the Fulbert colonels that worked with him in their staff cars, just sitting down there waiting for that helicopter to come back. We'd have loved to have been the flea on there behind during that period. But you know, I actually remember that evening speaking with one of them, and you know, we were all excited. We simply did not know what to do. They were tight-lipped. These were men who had flown in World War II and in the Korean War. They were pilots. In fact, most of the people that were MCCCs, the commanders, were you know, full-fledged airmen who had been taken out of the skies and stuck underneath the South Dakota ground for a three-year tour of duty. So they weren't real happy flyers. But they were cool characters. They knew what to do. You asked a little bit earlier if they could launch. And one of the stories about how that worked, George, is that the two commanders, the commander and his deputy, from any capsule could launch his flight immediately by throwing simultaneously two keys. So you sat within 10 feet of each other in two separate chairs, and you had a key, and your commander, your second had a key. And if the two of you agreed, you could launch. And nothing could be done to call these missiles back. They had no abort features whatsoever. There was no way to get them out of the sky.
So like those movies in James Bond where you had
exactly
one guy who decided he wasn't going to turn the key and the other guy holds a gun to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's real then. They
that's
both
real.
Have to turn that key. Okay.
I always thought, George, a little piece of string and a small pair of vice grips would do the trick.
Yeah, really.
You know, it never made sense to me why one launch control officer would want to shoot the other, because then the missile doesn't go at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, without that pair of vice grips and the string.
Yeah.
But the low-tech solution. And then, you know, they had a curious feature. In case the wing was devastated by a nuclear attack, 6 hours later, all the other missiles would go. So once that fire code got out into the system, it lay dormant for 6 hours in the other 140 missiles. But after 6 hours, they started.
And were the silos missile-proof from an attack, John?
They had a huge blast door over the top of them, 60-ton blast door that this object was kind of sitting on. And they could take a nearby hit. Anything, you know, half a mile probably or something like that.
But not a direct hit.
Not a direct hit. A direct hit would take them out. And that was the shell game, George. You know, it was the Russian planners wanted to know which one of our missiles was online.
Right.
So, you know, every night we might have 10 or 12 down for repairs, so they would not have to target those silos. And then, of course, they would like to know which cities those particular missiles were headed to. And so we kept all that information highly classified.
Was there a moment where you thought that perhaps the Russians had sent a vehicle to do some spying as opposed to some kind of a extraterrestrial UFO?
I don't think so. You know, I certainly didn't, and I'm sure from the very beginning, this was a flying saucer. These were extraterrestrials. If that had been like a Russian strike team, they'd had their guns out, they'd gone through the fence, you know, they were trained, they knew what to do with that situation. But goodness, you know, I mean, here were these boys, you know, just a year out of high school, with 12 weeks of training and made into APs, and they encountered this kind of luminous 30-foot long object on top of the silo. I mean, they didn't know what to do.
How long did the object stay there?
It must have been there an hour.
Nobody.
Just hovering.
Sitting, and then they reported, and the second wave of sighters also saw small luminescent objects leave the object, float around the silo in intelligent-looking patterns, looking at our infrared radar and our on-site structures and that kind of thing. And then when it came time to leave, they went back inside the ship, whatever these lights were, and everything took off together.
Now, do we know if any of the missiles were rendered useless or anything like that, or was this object merely hovering for about an hour and then it left?
Yeah, that's, you know, again, probably part of the more secret part of the story. Peter knows of a similar case, and I had not heard about it until I talked with Peter here just the other day at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, the year later. And after a very similar type of sighting took place, and these missiles at Malmstrom, same type of missiles that we had there at Ellsworth, were rendered non-operational. They began to develop what we called a GNC no-go fault, so the can would come offline. And that often happened if there was a vibration that disturbed the autocollimator, if it lost its kind of bearings, or if there was a magnetic source nearby. So, but my understanding from, you know, kind of new information here is that, yes, there were. The missiles were taken offline by this object and similar objects at other bases.
I'd like to, if I could cut in here for just a second,
indeed,
George, I'd like to clarify that case. I think it was from 1967, but the officer involved in the 67 case at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana has actually been on this program. I can mention his name because he's gone public. His name is Bob Salas.
Yes.
And that case was brought to the public attention by the Computer UFO Network up here in Seattle. Jim Klotz did a great deal of investigation and brought it to public attention. I've talked to Bob, and the interesting thing is the comparison between these two cases, because it, I believe I'm correct in saying that Bob Salas, and I think I have the year right,
you do, yeah,
knew absolutely nothing about the 1966 case in South Dakota. This is how thoroughly sealed off these cases can become after they've taken place, after the military's gotten their hands on them and instructed everybody not to talk. So it's a classic case of how you can just remove these incidents from public attention, even from military attention, and nobody knows about them unless, except for radio programs like this. And I think it's imperative that the American people who are paying the bills for these weapon systems know exactly what's going on.
Indeed. And that, again, to urge those, the airmen and officers from the period that went through this and who actually saw these things happen, to just file these reports so that we can begin to network, because this networking that Peter's talking about is going to show us a picture, a larger pattern picture, and that pattern is probably more important than any individual sighting. You know, this is just something that happened to me that night. I wasn't really personally involved. I didn't see the object. It happened now, you know, 40 years ago. But as part of a pattern, it's a dangerous pattern, and it's exactly what Peter talks about. That is,
John,
go ahead.
Did many of the men at the silo area and at the base talk about this episode after it occurred?
Absolutely. And, of course, we were all told not to. But you know, I visited with those men that I knew, and they confirmed, you know, what happened. You know, we haven't quite finished telling the story, and there, so it's a little more exciting anecdotes to it. As this helicopter approached, and it was obviously closing, you know, these were little Hercs, as it approached the silo, it was obvious that it was coming. They had their lights on and whatnot. That's when the object began to pack up its little objects and float up over the fence and off away from the base area towards the north northeast. And as it began, you know, it wasn't in any hurry. You know, it just it kind of toyed with the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave chase, but when the object decided to leave the area, it left. And you could hear the helicopter pilots, you know, I heard the helicopter pilots talking about it, it just practically vanished, you know, before their eyes, sped up and disappeared.